Committee to order. It's about 1:26. Today is April 15th. And we have four pieces of legislation that we'll be hearing today. I'd like to bring up House Bill 302 first, the Alaska Gas Corporation. And we'll get to Senate Bill 319 when the senator can come here, because he is testifying in another meeting. So at this time, we'll take up House Bill 302, and we have Representative Stevens, Green, Fate, myself, Masick, Chenault, Krutula, and Kastner available for the meeting today. So if we can have Representative Whitaker come forward and give us an introduction to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With your indulgence, I'll have my aide, Laurie, back this time. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you House Bill 302. House Bill 302 will establish, upon passage, the Alaska Gas Corporation. We've talked about a gas line in the state of Alaska for quite some time. There are those of us who think that a legislative effort of this nature can facilitate the construction of a successful project. And hence the bill was introduced. Since then, a new element has been introduced to the mix. That element is the petition initiative effort that we'll put before the voters this November. Another gas entity. And that gas entity will be the, I think it's a, is that a corporate entity or a?
It is a
court of sorts. That also is a corporate entity. The problem with that initiative, Madam Chair, is this. It requires a specific route. Rather than letting the market determine where gas should or should not go, it is specific to a Prudhoe Bay to Valdez LNG approach to gas. We've gone beyond that, and I think that we would muddy the waters significantly unless we provide an alternative to that initiative. House Bill 302 does that. You'll see in your packet a legal opinion from Jack Chenoweth that indicates that he sees no reason that House Bill 302 is not significantly similar to the initiative as to make the initiative moot. Having said that, Madam Chair, I am more than prepared to go into detail with regard to House Bill 302. I might say that generally, in addition to being a better idea than the current initiative, the effect of House Bill 302 is significant. Firstly, there are significant revenue advantages to the state relative to ownership. There are, in addition, many competitive issues at stake with regard to pipeline access, and there are also in-state usage issues with regard to a natural gas line. All of that being the case, it seems appropriate, if not imperative, that the state have an ownership position with regard to natural gas pipeline. With that, I am available for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Whitaker. Are there any questions for the representative? Hearing none, thank you for your comments. I suppose this bill was taken up in the Special House Committee on Oil and Gas, and
it was,
we've all
sure.
worked on it quite a bit. I don't know if we have members here that's part of that committee. Representative Bates, you're on the oil and gas, and you took this bill up
right
over there. Do you have any thing to share with the committee on this bill?
No, but the sponsor has spoken. Thank you, Madam Chair. The sponsor has spoken. This has the legal opinion, which speaks very well for it. It's a little broader in scope, and I think it's a very good bill, as adjudicated by the Oil and Gas Committee.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Whitaker. I don't believe we have anybody online to testify on House Bill 302, or is there anybody in Juneau here that has signed up? Hearing none.
Just a very brief at ease. Very brief at ease.
We'll take a brief, very brief at ease.
Madam Chair, I would move this bill forward with the personal statements.
Yes, it has zero. Is there any objection to moving House Bill 302 out of committee? Hearing none, House Bill 302 is moved out of House Resource Committee. And we'll take up Senate Bill 328, Big Game Hunters Accompanied by Guide. I believe we have someone from Senator Halford's office here.
He was here. Was he getting for
you? Yes, please. Bill 328, it's an act requiring that a non-resident big game hunter be accompanied by a big game guide who is providing big game hunting services to the non-resident under a contract with the non-resident or who is employed by a big game guide who has a contract to provide big game hunting services to the non-resident. And do we have the... If you can please come forward, give us your name and affiliation for the record, and give us your testimony on Senate Bill 328. Bill,
thank
welcome
you, Chairman,
to the committee.
This is Bill Stoltz from Chugiak, representing Senator Halford, present this legislation. Let me catch up here for a moment. Senator, Senate Bill 328 is a very narrow scope fix to remedy. To really comply with the intent of the guide bill was in 1996. There have been Department of Law decisions that have allowed a loophole where non-resident assistance guides because the Department of Law made the interpretation that they were guiding themselves. They didn't need to comply with the same status that the legislation intended, and this is to remedy the legislation. It's a very narrow fix to remedy the law to tighten it to comply with what the legislature originally intended several years ago. In light of the Department of Law's Attorney General opinion.
For the record, Co-Chair Scalzi and McGuire has joined us. Bill, with this bill here. So that means people that come up here, they would have to have a guide that's from Alaska to hunt up here?
Chairman Masick, they would have to sign a contract with a guide, with a registered or a master guide. And the qualifications for assistant guide, I'm not as familiar with the whole industry as Senator Halford is. But, the qualifications for the assistant guide are fairly minimal. You have to have hunted in Alaska at some point over a two-year period, I believe, and you have to get a letter of recommendation from a local biologist, which is, that's my understanding, it's a fairly easy process. The kind of ties in on the issue of guiding. The state isn't able to restrict non-resident guides because of interstate commerce issues and so forth. That's been ruled. This is closing a very narrow loophole. Senator Halford was brought to his attention by other guides, I believe a guide here in Southeastern, and it only affects the big game species, brown bear, all sheep, mountain goat, and if I'm missing one, Representative Fate will probably know it.
Yeah, grizzly, brown, mountain goat, sheep. Two bears, a sheep, and goat.
Are there any questions to Bill? Representative Chenault?
I guess I would have one question. still going over trying to get it in my mind, but you say currently there's a loophole where they can... actually have clients and not be covered by big game guy, registered guy.
Representative Chenal, through the chair, it's the loophole is an assistant guide can guide another guide, is how they've interpreted it, or say they're guiding themselves.
Under the sponsor statement, the third paragraph down, that would pretty much narrow down what it would do in changing the proposed statutes.
Well, I understand that, Madam Chairman, but I guess my question is under Section 0854630, in order to get an assistant guide license, you have to obtain written recommendation from a registered guide, state trooper, fish and game. I don't want to read the whole thing, but who is familiar with that person or who intends to employ that person as an assistant guide. So I guess if that's the case, that they have to, I'm assuming, get a piece of paper from a written recommendation from a guide then before they can get their license. Then why we need this.
Mr. Stone.
Madam Chairman, it was the intent of the original law. Why we need it is our Department of Law has said that it has created this loophole, as often happens with legislation. Like the original statute, if it was interpreted as the legislature intended, we probably wouldn't be addressing this. There's the Attorney General's office has created the loophole, and I imagine it was because an assistant guide pursued the issue. But this is just complying with the policy of a previous legislature. But if there's a question on the policy, that's really a policy call individually, I guess.
Okay, thanks.
So right now, then, Alaska law states that non-resident or non-resident alien cannot hunt brown bear and grizzly bear, mountain goat, or sheep without the services of a registered or mattered guide. So under this bill, then, the non-resident can come in to the state with their guide, but they would have to go with a guide from Alaska and get a contract and be able then to go hunt. That's how I'm reading.
Madam Chairman, assistant guide would have to, if they were going to hunt the big game species up here, they would have to follow the same strictures of all other non-residents hunting in Alaska. They would follow the same statutes. Ms. Claire?
Well, I guess I'm just hearing the debate with Representative Chenault. Chenault, you're talking about someone coming up here to be licensed to take people out hunting, or I didn't...
No, maybe I... Madam Chairman, maybe I misunderstood where we're going. I thought that what it had to do with was assistant guides or somebody who's registered as an assistant guide being able to take people out hunting without being supported by a master guide. Is my interpretation of that wrong?
No, so if they're working, Madam Chairman, if they're working under a guide, they can.
If they're working under a guide, that's perfectly legal. That's how I understand it. I guess my question is that if they're not working under a guide, is that the loophole we're trying to fix? That if they're not working under a guide, or not licensed, or to get, but. My interpretation of the statutes is that they have to have recommendation from a person who intends to employ that person as the guide.
Representative Chenault, Madam Chairman, that your interpretation is correct, that the change is they would have to, under this statutory change, they would have to be under a contract, they would have to sign a contract with a registered guide if they're a non-resident. They would have to comply with the same requirements as any other non-resident coming up. We've had... Over the past only contacts we've had on this outside of the public testimony in the Senate has been from I think there have been guides, one from Ohio, one from St. Petersburg, Florida, and one from Big Sky, Montana, wanting to know what's going on and if it was just going to screw up their brown bear or bell sheep hunt they had planned to take themselves out on.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I understand in terms of my community what's going on. We have a large Kodiak bear population and a lot of several master guides who employ assistant guides, and they can be often people who have very little experience and they're very dangerous out there. So it seems to me like it makes a lot of sense that the assistant guide be employed by the master guide. That's all you're really saying here, is that that person has to be employed by a master guide.
Oh, Madam Chairman, actually, for the purpose of hunting, they have to have a contract. If they are an assistant guide, they have to comply with the same requirements as any other non-resident coming up. They have to, if they're going to go out on a brown bear hunt, they have to have a contract with the master guide or registered guide who has met all the requirements that this legislature has laid out. And they've been to, I hope I'm not confusing this more.
Okay. Representative McGuire.
Does the contract have to be for money, or can it be nominal?
Madam Chair, Representative McGuire, that's not spelled out, and I think part of this is trying to work within the constraints of what's doable. And I think if there's a registered or master guide who's willing to allow this person to do it and take the put their reputation and their livelihood at stake to have this guy going out by themselves, and I imagine they could sign just a paper contract with a master guide.
And just a follow up, if I might, Madam Chairman, has the constitutionality of this been changed to the Interstate Commerce Clause?
Madam Chairman, Representative McGuire, I'm not familiar with all the minutiae, but this issue has been, and I don't know the cases. I think that's why we don't have any restrictions on non-resident guides that come up here. I don't know I couldn't cite the court cases, but there is case history on this issue.
But what you are saying now is that if you're a non-resident guide and an assistant, I mean, as Representative Stevens said, could by all accounts be very inexperienced, and I give you that. But an assistant could also be very experienced. Could in fact be a master guide out of Montana that is a non-resident coming here and therefore can only serve as an assistant. Is that correct?
That's a possibility.
And so my only question in that line of logic is, I think we enacted it for safety reasons and for preservation of the species and those types of things. And so I'm just starting to get a little concerned that we're getting into an area where people who might otherwise be equally as qualified, if not more, are denied a privilege simply on the basis of their residency in another state.
I think, Madam Chairman, the difference might be the ability to earn a living at the commerce section as opposed to the recreational aspect of it. That might, again, I'm not a lawyer. And I don't know, I'm not apologizing for that either.
No.
Representative Petula's benefit.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. OH.54, does that require that to be a master guide, you have to be an Alaska resident and pass certain requirements?
No, Representative Green, you don't have to be.
So that the example that Representative McGuire pointed out, that a master guide from Montana can come up here with somebody else and he's not in violation of this should this pass.
Let's see. That's, you know what, I've lost my, I'm not sure I can answer that one.
Can you rephrase your question?
Well, my compadre here is a master guide in Montana, and I'm from Helena, and I want to go up to Alaska and hunt. So we go up there, and we're complying with this. I haven't gotten a contract or anything else with a master guide from Alaska, but I do have a master guide with me.
Madam Chairman, with the Indulgence Committee, can I defer to the occupational licensing?
Yes, you can, please come forward.
Reciprocity.
Reciprocity. I just got that today on the floor to know. You can give us your name and affiliation for the record.
Sure. My name is Catherine Reardon. I'm director of the Division of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Community Economic Development, and we do the guide licensing in the state. I don't think I've ever appeared before this committee. We issue guide licenses regardless of residency. So a Montana master guide could come up here and apply for a guide license, and if he or she qualifies, then he or she would get an Alaska license. They can't just come up with their Montana license and start practicing. There isn't that kind of reciprocity, but like any other citizens in the United States, they're eligible for a license if they meet the qualifications. The qualifications do include experience as an assistant guide in Alaska, so it wouldn't be an instant process. They'd probably have to spend several years working at earning the qualifications to have a guide license.
Is that under 0854?
Yes, 0854 contains all of the qualifications and regulation of hunting guides. The statute being amended here is the Fish and Game statute that requires under some circumstances that someone must be accompanied by a licensed guide.
I understand that, but it says an assistant guide under, and I'm concerned about does that statute specify what you just said?
Yes, sir, it does.
Are there any other questions, Representative Fate?
Yeah, it's taking kind of software, Representative Green. If a guide from Montana has a contract with other citizens from Montana, it could either be in the singular or plural, to take them on a bear hunt. And that guide then has to be accompanied because he does not have an Alaskan guide license, although he has a Montana guide license. If that guide from Montana then contracts with a guide from Alaska, what happens to those people who contracted with the original Montana guide to go on a bear hunt? Do they also have to individually contract with the Alaskan licensed guide, or do they come under the qualifications as being contracted by the Montana guide, who then has to conform to Alaska law with a resident licensed guide?
The chair, representative, they would have to contract with Alaska Guide. The way the guide law works, it says that in order to offer guiding services in Alaska, you must be an Alaska licensed guide. A Montana licensed guide who doesn't hold a license here is just like any other member of the public from Montana. The fact you have a guide license in Montana is irrelevant. You're like any other non-Alaska resident who wants to come up here and hunt or work.
Just to follow through, that's good for the guide. But there are several people from Montana that have a contract with that guide. Now, where do they fall? Does that make their contract with the original Montana guide null and void so that they also have to contract with the licensed guide from Alaska to hunt?
Madam Chair, a Montana guide should not be contracting with Montanans to conduct a guide in Alaska, conduct a hunt in Alaska. To conduct a hunt in Alaska, you have to be an Alaska guide. So there shouldn't be anyone out there who is saying, I can take you on a guided hunt in Alaska, unless that person has an Alaska license. He would be, when he entered the state and started doing any activity, he would be breaking the law.
That answers the question. Okay.
Can I get my money back from Guide Stevens?
It's too late.
Caveat emptor. Representative Chenault.
Yeah, yes. I'm still mulling this thing over. I know I'm slow. Quit laughing at me. According to the sponsor statement, some court has interpreted that the law created a loophole that allows the non-resident or the non-resident alien assistant guides who only have met the minimal threshold of qualifications to hunt these big game species without the services of a registered master guide. Under the proposed changes, an assistant guide would be able to accompany the non-resident or non-resident alien only if the registered or master guide employs him. My interpretation of 854.630
states just exactly that.
Madam Chair,
am I
you're not missing anything. That's it's not a court. It was our Department of Law has ruled that these assistant guides can walk through that. If I'm saying that correctly, there's been a ruling that they can under our Department of Law's interpretation don't have to comply with that statute, and that's what we're trying to fix.
Madam Chair, if I could make a stab at it here. The requirement to get a guide license is that you have, or an assistant guide license, is that you have these recommendations. But the recommendations, I believe, don't have to come just from a guide. They could come from a fish and game biologist or several other categories of people. They just have to recommend you one time to get the license. They could have recommended you and you got the license 5 years ago. It's not that they have to say that for a particular hunt they're going to be involved with you. And I think a lot of people get their recommendations from others than guides, if I'm recalling how that statute works. So you all probably understand this, but what's been happening is people have been getting Alaska assistant guide licenses for the specific purpose of coming up in here and hunting on their own or hunting with their friends. That's the loophole. They're not actually wanting to work as guides. They're qualifying as assistant guides, some folks from Florida say, because they don't want to have to pay a guide when they come up here. And the way they've been able to do that is because the current statute says that you have to be personally accompanied by an assistant guide. And they say, I'm accompanying myself. I went and I got an assistant guide license. I'm accompanying myself so I can come up here and hunt whenever I want without getting an Alaskan guide. And I can bring my friends, too, because I'll be accompanying them. So that's what started happening. People were getting licenses to avoid hiring guides. Maybe that was... Obviously,
seems pretty clean. I mean, that states why the bill is needed. I guess part of the reason we require a guide in Alaska, too, is because of the dangerous game, the big game, and the areas. The guides from out of state are not familiar with Alaska, and there's so many different terrain here that could be dangerous, so I can understand that. Representative Snow, did you
get a
clear reading of it?
No, I'm done. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for the sponsor, staff, or the Division of Occupational and Licensing? Hearing none, thank you for your comments. I guess we'll see if there's anybody else then that want to testify on Senate Bill 328. Is there anybody in teleconference that needs to testify on Senate Bill 328? If not, we'll close this for committee for public comment and open it up for committee discussion. Representative Stevens.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how germane this is, but the big game hunters and the guides, the master guides in Kodiak have really a wonderful program where they are trying to get villagers to become guides again. They used to be guides, but they've sort of grown out of that business. And so it becomes a matter of economic development, which I think McGuire might appreciate. And I think anytime we can do something to encourage and it does seem to me that this code closes the loophole of non-residents, and I think that's to the good of this bill.
That's my understanding, Representative Stevens. Is there any other discussion?
Would you like a motion?
Yes, I would, Representative McGuire.
Madam Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill 328 out of this committee with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendation. Fiscal note, plural, pardon me.
Is there any objection to moving Senate Bill 328 from committee? Hearing none, Senate Bill 328 is moved from committee. And we are going to take up Senate Bill 308, the Coastal Zone Management Program Council. Do we have someone from Senator Terrio's office here to carry the bill? Now, Representative Green, is this similar to the bill that... No, this isn't yours, but the Anchorage Coastal.
Yeah.
This is the Alaska.
Management.
Right, okay.
Not coastal.
Yeah.
is like the one that Ogun had, like Scott, but they changed
it. Yeah, it's pretty familiar.
Yeah,
yeah.
They changed it.
I guess this here pretty much spells out the coastal management program and responsibilities of the policy council. Thank you for being here. If you could give us your name and affiliation and give us your testimony on Senate Bill, CS for Senate Bill 308 Finance.
Yes, thank you. For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Joe Balash, staff to Senator Terrio. Senate Bill 308, as has been amended over the course of time here, originally began in a fashion very similar to House Bill 439, making a couple of other changes. After 439 moved over to the Senate, it, of course, became the vehicle. So all of the petition initiative, all of the individual project petition stuff came out. And what we were left with are essentially two things. One is a prohibition on the adoption of the state's regs and statutes in local coastal district plans, and then also is a provision to allow the permitting of a North Slope natural gas pipeline that follows the Trans-Alaska pipeline route to Canada or to Alaska Tidewater to be phased. The importance of that provision is, I don't think, can be understated. A project involving this size and quantity and number of permits and the complexity is so great that in order for a consistency determination to be rendered, you have to submit everything all at once to the agencies to look at in their entirety. This allows the agencies to proceed in whatever fashion is deemed to be best. And with that short version of the details, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions, Representative Green?
This isn't a question, Madam Chairman, but I think kind of piggybacking onto your statement, having done some permitting up there, quite often what happens, as he said, is that in this process there are many nuances. And to try and say, okay, we'll use this color styrofoam cup way in advance of the time that portion of this process is necessary, we might find that the time we get there it should be green or it should be yellow or half as much of a cup. And so some of these things you can't foresee until you're into the process. And so I think that's why you need the stages, so that you can be flexible enough to move as necessary rather than stand way back here and say we're going to do the whole process and find halfway down the road, whoops, we kind of G'd and we should have hawed. Happened to be a Neil Skinner.
Representative Stevens.
Just a question of Joe, and this may not apply, but my question is that comparing the oil pipeline to this gas pipeline, was the oil pipeline phased, or did that occur before all of these requirements were in place?
Through the chair, Representative Stevens. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline was permitted and constructed in the early 70s. Our Coastal Zone Management Program didn't come into place, I think, until 1977 is when the bill passed. So basically, no, it did not need to be phased. And as far as how all of the different stages happened, then the array of statutes and legislation that have been enacted both at the federal and the state level is unbelievably complex, and it's hard to say how the Trans-Alaska pipeline system would have been permitted under today's regime.
And a follow-up, that's a very good comment. I'm pleased to hear that. So what you're saying is if the rules have been in place, and if we had had to get all of the permits done for the oil pipeline, it's very unlikely it would have all occurred in the right sequence and at the right times.
Through the chair, Representative Stevens, I wasn't even born. The project was permitted.
Well, you had my vote a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
A little order here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, are there any other questions? Representative Kutula.
Madam Chair, what are you going to have to know up front, though, for the project before you allow it to go forward? What kinds of things are you going to have to know?
Through the chair, Representative Kurtula, I think that the language leaves the discretion in the hands of the agency responsible for rendering the consistency determination. The statutes are unchanged in that regard, so it will be the Division of Governmental Coordination that ultimately makes the decision in concert with the various agencies. As I understand it, the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Environmental Conservation have been contacted, and this has been run by them, and they agree. So as far as what sort of information will have to be provided, that the language doesn't stipulate any of that.
Follow up.
Thanks. What's going to happen if an agency starts out and all of a sudden in one of the phases it determines that it doesn't meet the consistency determination? What will happen if you already have, let's say you have part of the pipe laid and then you run into a snag and you can't make the second phase work? What will happen?
Through the chair, Representative Kurtula, I think that trying to separate out the different versions of the different bills that are running around this building. The phasing can be based on construction sequences, can be based on distinct areas of the state that the pipe is running through. And for the most part, as I understand it, there is a local coastal plan for the North Slope Borough, and a couple of the rivers coming down from the Beaufort Sea, but that's a very limited area where they will have to get the consistency determination for the rest of the 1,800 miles, I believe it is. The pipe won't be running through a coastal district, and so the areas and parts of the pipeline, the processing facilities, conditioning plants, all of those will be in a very discrete area that should be able to be dealt with prior to any real hiccups in the processing. The question really becomes the most complex because, as I understand it, the project applicant would have to know exactly which route the pipe was going to take, which rivers it was going to cross, which ones it was going to go over, under, what time of year, and to have an idea of exactly when those things were going to happen and at what time of the year for the entire length of the pipe is virtually impossible to know, and this will allow them to concentrate only on that part of the pipe which will be affecting a coastal district.
Just one final question. So basically you're going to leave the determination of how this is going to be done completely up to the agency to decide how they're going to allow phasing and what they're going to look at to allow it. Is that right? The statute's completely delegating to the division.
Through the chair, Representative Kurtula, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Co-chair Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe, on the Section 3, Number B, could you give a brief explanation of that, the meaning of that section, where it says municipality or coastal resource service areas not comply with A of this section, the Alaska Coastal Policy Council may enter an order deleting the incorporation by reference of statutes and administrative regulations.
Yes, through the chair. In Section 1, we are putting in place the prohibition on the adoption of regs and statutes. And as I understand it, the Coastal Policy Council has already kind of ordered that in, and I'm not sure if I'm stating it absolutely correctly, but that's my general understanding, is that administratively they've already said you will not use our state's regs and statutes in your local plans. In Section 3, Part A gives the local coastal districts 1 year to comply with this statutory change. Section B of Section 3, or Part B of Section 3, allows the Coastal Policy Council to issue an order once that year is up, deleting those specific references in the local plans if the local districts haven't taken the steps themselves to do so. And I don't want to speak for the department on this, and I'm not sure if, oh, yes, Mr. Galvin is here. He may be able to speak to the arrangements they've made regarding the local districts and their ability to make those changes.
Okay. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. We have a couple of people that have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 308. John Shively, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I am.
Yes. Can you please give us your name and affiliation, give us your testimony on Senate Bill 308?
Yes, Madam Chairman, my name is John Shively. I'm representing Foothills Pipelines. We are in support of this legislation. I believe, as has been stated by the sponsor, that trying to get a consistency determination on the entire gas line project up front does not make sense because of the complicated nature of the project. We've worked with the administration, both the Division of Governmental Coordination and the other agencies, and we, I think, have all come to the same conclusion in that project should be phased, and that how it's phased is something that will be worked out between the agencies and the applicant. To be frank, although there are some advantages to the applicant in the phasing situation, there are also some risks because we will have to have more than one consistency determination. But the kind of thing that we're thinking about, to partially answer Representative Kutula, is right now we're trying to finalize a decision on the right-of-way state lands. We already have the right-of-way across federal lands in Alaska, and under the current law, that right-of-way could not be issued until there was a consistency determination, and the consistency determination couldn't be issued until every permit was basically set to go, every stream crossing, every DEC permit. This allows decisions like the right-of-way to be made without without having to approve the whole project. I would be very surprised that any applicant would proceed with construction, although that's technically allowed under this language, with construction of any part of, actual construction of any part of the gas line until the whole thing was, so I think it would be very unlikely that it would be pipe in the ground one place that would then would be stopped because of another consistency determination. Madam Chairman, I would be pleased to answer any questions if anybody has them.
Thank you, John. Are there any questions? Hearing none, thank you for your testimony, John.
Welcome.
Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on Senate Bill 308?
Thank you. My name is Patrick Galvin. I'm the Director of Division of Governmental Coordination in the Governor's Office. And we are responsible for implementing the Coastal Management Program. And I just wanted to just reiterate a couple of the points that have been made already today. We did participate in some discussions with some of the other agencies that would be involved in permitting a pipeline project. and came to the conclusions that were indicated earlier, that a project of the magnitude that we would anticipate here would be so large that even under our current phasing law, which allows phasing in certain circumstances, it probably technically would not meet those requirements, but from a practical standpoint would almost be too large for us to tackle all at once, given any amount of resources that we may want to throw at it. And also looking at it from the point of view of the public that may want to participate in a review of the project, if we tried to do it all at once, again, the magnitude would be so large, and while the applicant may be able to throw the resources at it, and the state may even be able to come up with resources that may be able to try to tackle it, the public would not be able to comprehend such a vast scale all coming down at the same time. And so while we recognize that there was a need to allow for phasing of a project along these lines, what we recognize is that, as I indicated, the current phasing law, which was drafted primarily looking at the sequencing of oil and gas development going from lease sales to exploration to development, was limited in its application to this type of a project. And that rather than coming up with a exemption or trying to change the language of the phasing law in order to allow for a project of this type to fit under it, it may have some unexpected consequences of allowing other projects that would not be nearly this scale of fitting that same justification. And so we felt that structurally the proper approach was the one taken by this bill, which was to say that the natural gas pipeline is so unique that it needs to have a separate provision of our phasing law to allow for phasing in a manner that would be decided at that time. With regard to the other sections of the bill, primarily Section 1 and the tie-in at Section 3, and it became a practice for those plans to periodically just incorporate state law in an area that they didn't feel they needed to add anything to state law. And so they would just say the rules of Department of Fish and Game with regard to this are incorporated into our plan, or the rules with regard to contingency spill response requirements are adopted into our plan. And what we found was that those incorporations by reference legally froze in time the requirements that existed at that state law at the time that that plan was adopted. And so as those state laws were refined and updated and brought current, the local plans kept the old rules in place. And so we ended up in a situation a number of times where we had conflicting rules that may apply to an individual project, even though the intent was to merely take the state law into the local plan. And so over the last, it's been 4 or 5 years that this problem has been recognized, we have encouraged the local districts to update their plans and try to remove these provisions, and frankly, they haven't. And the reason is primarily that they don't have the time, the interest, the money to go about doing that, and going through the review process just for that purpose isn't something that they are motivated to do. And so what we see as an advantageous portion of this law is it allows the Coastal Policy Council, as the body that oversees the program, to take that step on their own, whereas under the current process, the district has to initiate that attempt, and we haven't found that to be something that they are willing to take up. So this does offer the opportunity to rectify the situation in a way that doesn't require the districts to take that initial step.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Cortula and then Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Director, is it 4640094? Is that the basic statute that would apply today unless we make this change?
Right.
Right.
Can I ask you, what is it in that statute that you really think you're going to have problems with in phasing? Because I would think that this would be a project that would obviously have to be phased.
Actually, the answer goes back to an example that Representative Green alluded to earlier, which is that there may be projects where you might identify something up front and say, his example was the styrofoam cup is what we're going to be using. And over the course of the analysis of that project, when you get to the point where that actually becomes an issue, you may find that that's not the case. Well, that example actually fits the model that is in the current law. And the current law takes into account that opportunity. It says that you can phase a project where developing information is going to be obtained during the course of an earlier phase that may result in changes at a subsequent phase. What we found in looking at how a natural gas line project would be developed is that there probably is the ability to obtain the information with regard to all of the stream crossings, all of the engineering that would be expected to take place within the coastal zone. However, from both a capital investment standpoint, in terms of how much are you going to invest at the upfront part of the project development, and also from an information gathering standpoint, we don't think that it would be practical that all that information would be available all at once at the front end of the project. And so for reasons that don't go to the acquisition of developing information, that go primarily to the practical implications of gathering information on a project this size, we don't see it all coming in at once. And part of it is actually, as former Commissioner Shively indicated, right now the way things are sort of developing, the applicant that's furthest along right now is looking at getting the state right-of-way. And as was indicated, the right-of-way cannot be issued until a consistency determination has been made associated with that decision. And what that means is, while...
Can you wrap up, please?
Okay. So while we may be able to make a consistency determination with regard to the issues that are associated with that right-of-way, the route, where the pipe's going to go, and what streams are actually going to be crossed, what we won't have available to us are the engineering, the spill response requirements, and all those other things that would naturally go into the consistency review that we would want to make a decision on. And we wouldn't be able to say, yes, you're entirely consistent. But we could make it with regard to the information that's available for the right-of-way if this language were to go through.
I must be missing something, because I thought the phasing would have allowed you to have limited what you're reviewing in that phase at any rate, unless, you know, you've got something that you know or it was made a part of the record. You don't have to know everything completely up front. You do have to know reasonably foreseeable or the significant effect. But are you requiring a project that's phased currently to bring in every single piece of information up front? Now?
The information that is available, and that's actually the problem, is what information is available. Because what we have is we have a number of projects that will come in and they'll say, well, we don't have the finances now to get that information, and so we would like to get just this part permitted right now. And under the phasing law, that information is available. It's just they're choosing not to obtain it at this point. And so in the application, the concern is that if we interpret the law differently than we currently do for this gas line project, it's going to have a precedent in other projects, and that we'll end up with a much broader phasing opportunity than we currently have, just because we wanted to make that exception here.
I can finish.
Brief wrap-up.
Okay. So what you're saying is, the way that you're interpreting the statute is, if the information is available today, you would have to consider it. What you're not wanting to do is say that, well, this information might be available, but we're not going to take a look at it in the gas line, therefore we want an exemption which is what the bill would be, from looking at available information so that we don't harm the way we look at other projects.
Right.
Am I understanding right? Why are you not requiring available information to be brought in with the gas line? Is it the expense? Is that what the problem is?
It's both the expense and the magnitude that we see that if we're looking at the gas line in total from the treatment facility through the entire route, both on the north side, well, primarily on the north slope side, that the information that would be needed would be more than what could be brought to bear at the time that the either the applicant or the state would be interested in having that consistency determination made.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Co-Chair Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Patrick, you characterized some of the local management plans as being outdated and probably have not had the recent scrutiny that they have. There are, however, districts that have been very active in their local management plans. And I guess, how have you had any communication with municipalities on this particular bill, and what was their reaction?
We haven't talked about this particular bill. There has been a number of hearings from the Coastal Policy Council dealing with this topic. And the topic was something that engendered a great deal of debate, as I said, about 4 or 5 years ago when it first became a problem. And there wasn't an indication from any of the coastal districts, whether they be ones that have more current plans or the older plans, that finding that the incorporations of state law by reference, there wasn't an advantage that was brought forward.
Okay, do you have a plan to consult with the local districts in the first part?
Actually, the way that the bill is structured, you'll notice that subsection A, section 3, allows for the districts to first have the opportunity to amend their plans in order to make it compliant with the provisions of section 1. So they, if they felt that they wanted to deal with that particular issue in which they're incorporating state law, they would have the opportunity to come up with a way of doing that before the Coastal Policy Council would act. And so they would have that opportunity, and there would be communication at that point involved.
Yeah, I'm more concerned with input than being in compliance. So, anyway, thank you.
Thank you for your questions and your testimony. We have one person on line that wanted to testify, Matt Sue, LIO. Dana Olson, are you online for Senate Bill 308?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
I would like to recommend that this testimony be 3 minutes, so if you can please go ahead.
Yes, I've already faxed down my comments, and I've asked them to be incorporated in the bill's legislative history. I'm commenting on both the coastal management and the shallow gas, and that should have been faxed down there this morning. So I would ask that it be part of the legislative history. I just wanted to say briefly that the citizen involvement in this proposed bill, I'm very concerned about that aspect. Law doesn't presume that it's going to occur, and I think that the legislature needs to address that issue because the Coastal Management Act itself says that citizen involvement in all aspects of planning is required, and I feel that you will be negating the public process under a theory of some economic gain, but I don't see a legal and factual basis showing anything that you'll gain anything. These are obviously major, major program changes that have not been approved by the Secretary of Commerce, and one of the requests that I've made earlier on the history of this bill is that there be a title or a purpose of this bill. It seems to be whatever a catch-all for any issue that's out there, and it is creating an insufficiency of notice. I can't be all knowledgeable about all aspects, that it has to be more clear and precise. That's all I basically wanted to say today. I've volunteered previously to help set up a citizen involvement to make recommendations on program changes, and I have not been given any opportunity, nor have I heard of anyone else having that opportunity. I'm really quite disappointed in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Stevens?
Madam Chair, just a question of Dana Olson. You, a couple of times in your letter here, you comment on, you feel there's a need for a fiscal note. Could you comment further on that? What is the fiscal note you would expect on this bill?
Well, part of the problems that I find is that when the state hasn't done AS4603040, that's being an environmental plan. And all they have is a regulatory means to address things. There is a requirement for, under Title 38, which is an enforceable policy of the Coastal Management Program, to revise the outdated land use plans when necessary. And I've alleged for years and years, since 1984, that it's necessary. I've met with deaf ears. I'm being affected by this fact that it's not being revised when necessary. Also, the fiscal note for consideration of specific plans that are required under specific permits, I'm alleging that if the state can't do it and hasn't been able to do it since 1984, and I've even given an example of the Kinnick Arm Power process, I'm alleging that this would not constitute an adequate risk assessment. And therefore, I would be very objecting to this process.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate Bill 308? Hearing none, we will close public comment and open it up for committee debate. Representative Stevens.
I wonder if we could get the sponsor back and address the issue of the fiscal note. I'd like to hear the response to that, if you wouldn't mind.
You can please come forward.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Stevens, the fiscal note, if there were to be one that showed any dollar figures, there is going to be some expense borne by the agency in terms of ordering the coastal districts to fix their plans in Section 3, and there may be some involvement in that. As I understand it, the Coastal Policy Council has set some money aside for that. I would be happy if Mr. Galvin could correct me if I'm wrong. And as to Section 2, the phasing language, it, I would imagine, would make their job easier rather than harder when these applications come in. And as far as the agency's expenditures in relation to this, I'm not the person to provide testimony on that. I would think that Mr. Galvin could explain that a little better, but the agencies aren't going to have to do anything in response to this change in law. If the right-of-way application is processed along further, I think that there's a designated program receipts mechanism in place now that they are paying for the work being done at the gas pipeline office to help process that application. That's as far as I dare go.
I appreciate Joe's comments, but just to follow it through to the bitter end here, I would like to have Mr. Galvin come up and comment on the same issue, if he would.
Briefly, yes, please come and give us your answer.
I guess I just, are you concerned about fiscal impacts associated with sections 1 and 3 or with the phasing?
Certainly, I'm referring to Dana Olson's comment that there should be a fiscal note, and asking for your response to that.
My experience, Ms. Olson testified on this bill a number of times, and the times that she has testified have been primarily dealing with petition language that has been dropped from this bill, and her reference to the environmental planning is planning that's done by Department of Environmental Conservation and isn't related to any of the aspects of this program that we're dealing with here or what we deal with in our division. So it's really difficult to respond to that particular claim. And the merits of this particular bill itself, we found that it doesn't have a fiscal impact. And just brief clarification, the Coast Policy Council doesn't have money set aside for dealing with this aspect, but it does have an operating budget from our federal grant, and we see that the actions that are necessary under this bill would fit under that formal plan, so we don't see any additional fiscal impact. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. The chair would entertain a motion.
I have a, Madam, may I suggest an amendment to the legislation? I have a question and then a possible amendment, if I might. Could I, Mr. Galvin, come back up, please? I might clear it up. Through the chair, when you're making this consistency determination, and I'm understanding that what you're concerned about is that you may have things available, but they just absolutely won't be reasonable to try to look at everything. Nevertheless, I mean, at the heart of coastal management is trying to figure out effects of a project, and at the heart of most of the court cases about phasing seems to be that idea, that you try to take a look at what the effect is going to be as much as you know it. Are you planning on looking at the reasonably foreseeable effects, significant effects?
Yeah, my expectation is that when we are doing the consistency review for the right-of-way, it would be looking at the project in terms of all the effects associated with it. But what we found is that, and this is just the evolution of the program, as you're well aware, is that we've come to the point where now we're looking, as part of our consistency review, at the details, and it's the detail part that we need to be able to put off till later.
Well, would you have any, what's worrying me is with the kind of broad language that's currently in it, it seems to completely get away from, you know, looking at those effects. Would there be any harm in trying to restructure just slightly what you're looking at to include that you're also looking at the reasonably foreseeable significant effects? So you're not looking at any tiny detail, but you're using the traditional coastal zone language so that you don't run up against, you know, the phasing situation where you're saying you're not even going to be able to look at that. I mean, is there any harm in adding that language to it so that it's real clear in the legislation?
Yeah, we have to see how it fits in, but I think adding
some
language.
What you intended.
Yeah, that initially, that a first look that takes into account the significant effects of the project would still be keeping with our intent.
It's reasonably foreseeable. I don't have any qualms about you trying to sync up the universe, because I know that's not
right.
Possible, but I do have some concern about not including that. Thanks.
And again, looking at the significant effects and not dealing with the site-specific effects.
Right.
Representative Catrula, I think there's quite a bit of safeguards that are put into this bill. And
I'd like to make the motion, Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes.
Thanks. And the reason, the motion is on line 1, page 2, after in a manner that promotes review of proposed uses and activities, what we would do is add the language and the reasonably foreseeable significant effects. And then you just carry on. And the reason I like it, and I don't think it's really going to change what the division's going to do anyway, because under normal coastal management law, they really would have to take a look at that. But it might help in terms of information not only to the applicant, but to the agencies, what they really have to look at. It might save us from a court case later on. So that was my suggestion. Mr. Galvin's testimony is just that, you know, isn't far-fetched. It's not looking for things that you can't know, but looking at the reasonably foreseeable and the significant effects, which you could probably, this This committee could probably list them out almost right now from the gas line itself, but so it shouldn't be onerous, but at least it puts it into the law and makes me feel a whole lot more comfortable. So that's the motion.
Do you have comments about it? The proposed changes to the bill?
Madam Chair, I think the only thing I would say, not being a member of the body, is the language has been around for a few weeks now. These particular effects, I certainly couldn't comment as to how they would affect the bill, and I'm not prepared to answer on behalf of the sponsor what his thoughts are on the amendment.
Okay, well, Representative Kutula has offered the amendment, and we will have a roll call on the amendment.
Could I ask a question about that first?
Representative Green.
Madam Chairman. Beth, I'm wondering if somehow this isn't going to be a sponge to catch any kind of tears that may be thrown at the project, because if along the way, each phase, you then do what you think is necessary, plus you then, at each phase, have to bring up reasonably foreseeable adverse effects. And the concern,
Oh, it was significant instead of adverse. Yeah, no, I don't expect them to be trying to think of these.
Okay, I'm sorry. No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks for asking.
Representative Fate.
Well, I would just like you to restate the phrasing.
Sure. It would be it would read review of proposed uses and activities and the reasonably foreseeable significant effects.
Which is, where are you at now
page
exactly?
Two,
phase two, line.
Line one, at the very end of the line, after activities, you'd add in the language and the reasonably foreseeable significant effects. Then you would still have the language based upon the project's design, construction, sequence, and schedule. In all likelihood, the division or the agency is going to have to look at that anyway, but this just makes it very clear that you're going to be looking at the overall. You're not going to have to look at every tiny little detail, because that's why this has to be phased. I mean, that's really easy to understand. You couldn't require that up front. But you could require the broad look at what the effects are. And that will really help later on if this ever gets challenged, if the agency has done that, because they'll have an overall understanding. So that's why the amendment. Thank you.
Well, I would object to the amendment, and I think we should take a roll call. Take a roll call on the amendment.
No.
Representative Chenault?
No.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Stevens? Yes. Representative Katzmann? Yes. Representative Kutula? Yes. Co-Chair Massa? No. Co-Chair Scalzi? No. Passing was not a good idea.
You are required to vote. No, so amendment number one does not pass. This brings us back up to the bill. Senate Bill 308. Thank you, Representative Green. I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move to pass out of committee. Senate Bill 308 with personal recommendations and 059.
Thank you. Are there any objections to moving Senate Bill 308 out of committee? Hearing none, Senate Bill 308 is moved. Thank you for your time here. And we are now taking up Senate Bill 319, and I see we have Senator Torgerson here.
I object.
Object to bringing the bill before us?
No, for having us. You better out of town.
While talking before the
that'll be the day.
Oh, jeez.
Is that a way to start off?
Don't be mean to you.
You want a little background information?
Yes, please.
Okay, I'll simplify it. The shallow gas leasing program basically started as something more for the rural areas of our state, and it's turned into a commercial program more than it has one that's targeted to the rural areas for supplying gas. We have issued over 100 leases and have 200 more pending, just to back up some of the aspects of it going commercial. What this bill does is five things. It increases the revenue of the state by increasing the leases from $500 to $5,000. That more closely reflects the cost of DNR to process the leases. It also increases the annual rental fee an acre from 50 cents to a dollar. Requirement that DNR annually notify leaseholders by certified mail that the rent is due has been deleted. We're all in a big world now, and if you have this amount of money you're laying on the table with a rent, you should remember when to pay your dues. Removes the deadline for issuing leases. These deadlines proved to be unworkable and do not recognize the work that's required by DNR. Better reservoir management, the limitation on the depth of 3,000 feet has been replaced with a requirement that some portion of the field has to be at the 3,000-foot level. The total amount of acreage has been increased from the old statutory set of 46,080 acres to 100,000. And it removes the requirement that the applicant conduct a title search. DNR routinely conducts a title search for land before the leases are issued. And in addition, there are no title companies in the state that will give a subsurface a state warranty title. The fourth thing, the leasee must secure a bond as a precondition of the lease. If damages occur in the leases and the landowner cannot reach an agreement on the amount of damages, then either party can seek relief in the courts. The proposed new bonding would help protect service owners by ensuring that the substantial bonds are in place prior to expiration of development. And the fifth thing is actually just a conversion, a timeline for people to transition period for them to get the leases under this current leasing program. So, Madam Chairman, that is basically what the bill does.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Bates?
I have one. When we heard this in the Oil and Gas Committee, Senator, I questioned the amount of acreage from 100,000 and suggested that we square that off into six townships. And at that time, everybody seemed to be comfortable with that. And I was comfortable with it and was ready to actually make an amendment. Since that time, there's been suggested, and I would look forward to that eventually, making that amendment towards squaring off that township and making it six townships. Do you have any problem with squaring that up into six townships?
I don't think it'll ever be a square, is what you may be thinking of. Is, you know, it'll run in all kinds of different directions. But Mark Myers, who I think is on the line, called me about this morning and said there's might be an amendment to increase this. I'm basically going to go on their recommendation. They think it might be all right. I think nobody has 100,000 acres now, so I think we're jumping the gun a little bit, but I'll go on the recommendations of the department. And I think they were talking about adding another township to 133 or two more townships. Yeah. Okay. And he believes that might attract, particularly help Evergreen out for some of the stuff in the valley. As I told your committee, which I didn't tell this one of the concerns I had, and we were working on parallel paths before I went on this, is that people are tying up our acreage in the state waiting for stuff to happen. And the old thing of $500.50 an acre costs you nothing to tie up thousands of acres of oil and gas land and call it a shallow gas leasing. My bill was much more onerous than this. So I would keep that in mind when you're making increased acreage and other things, that it's something that we're just not allowing people to tie up. But again, I'm not going to object to it if there is an amendment, because I went on the recommendations of the people who are actually in the business, Mark Myers and Oil and Gas, and they've indicated that it was workable. So I'll go along with their recommendation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions, Representative Green?
Well, yes, Madam Chairman. I have a bit of the same concern. I can understand why an exploratory outfit might want to go in somewhat like a concession. I know in other countries, in order to try and prove up an area, they'll grant concessions. And they might fiddle around and find something here that if they had tried to find littler blocks like we generally lease in, it might not really be of an interest to them because they have to focus so much of their corporate worth to go in there. But I share the senator's concern that right now, if we would, we have $500 for so many acres, we go up to 5,000, but we're increasing the acreage significantly. And if we were to say something more like 10 cents an acre or something, so that as they grade, the acreage increases, so too does the rent, because I share your concern that pretty soon you're going to have enough of these things that any reasonably reasonable area that you might want to poke a hole in has already been leased up for almost nothing. And I am really concerned about that. I don't think that increase in rent would be a deterrent. I think what it would do is make people, well, if two's good, four ought to be better. Maybe we only need three, and we're willing to pay a little extra to get that three. But to increase this by almost 50% at the same rental seems to be a little bit of a jump. So I don't have an objection to the amount of acreage, but I think the rent ought to go up proportionally. So if we make that increase in acreage, I'd like to maybe bring up a second amendment.
But I was just going to remind Representative Green that this does increase to a dollar per acre.
Yes.
Are you talking about going above the dollar per
no,
acre?
No, that's fine. No. I was just looking at the number on section two there.
But we're going from 50 cents to a dollar again to recognize that, you know, that they have to pay.
And that's fine. Right. I think that's great. If that doesn't impact this, because 138,000 acres at 5,000 seems like that's not quite a dollar an acre, but...
One other thing, Madam Chairman, as we go farther into this commercialized shallow gas program and getting away from the old rural program, I had stated in the Oil and Gas Committee, in my own committee, that we may want to come back and visit a more user-friendly program just for the more rural areas of our state that it will use this for consumption in their community for power, for gas, or for electrical generation and some other things. So it's something that... again, this program didn't necessarily work well for that, but then it got too commercialized in the Nenana and Kenai Peninsula and Matsu areas. But I think you'll hear testimony from most of the industry that they're in favor of the bill.
Okay. Representative McGuire.
Thank you. Senator Torgerson, just one quick question, technical question. Page 2, line 31. Why did we delete out that the director shall execute the lease within 90 days after the completion of a title search? Or, I mean, you add in after the completion of a title search as opposed to within 90 days. I'm worried that'll stall the process up, and I'm just wondering why you deleted that out. Page 2, line 31.
Oh, okay.
It used to say that the director will execute the lease within 90 days, and now the new standard is after the completion of a title search.
Well, basically, because we never met the 90 days.
Okay.
We couldn't get the work done, mainly because of the heavy volume of work that they have. So we just took out that requirement completely because we really weren't not making the 90 days. But that'd be a good question to ask the division director, if the committee is looking at maybe another timeline, if there would be something more effective. But it was clear 90 days wasn't the right number. But maybe 6 months or something else would be a good number. I don't know. But in this case, they have people dedicated to doing the work, and it's just one of those things. When they get it done, it's done, and then they exercise the lease, and that's when it all starts. So.
I appreciate that, Senator Torgerson. I just want to make sure that there might be some incentive to try to get that through as quickly as possible.
I think the incentive in this case is more money for the DNR is scrambling to get you for their budget.
All right,
Mark, you owe me.
Are there any other questions for Senator Torgerson?
That's it?
That's it. Thank
Boy,
you.
Easy. You are easy. I'm not quite so scared now.
Thank you, Senator Torgerson. We're going to move to the teleconference. We have Jerry Booth.
Hello?
Yes, Jerry, if you could state your name and affiliation and your testimony for Senate Bill 319, and I'm going to impose a three-minute time limit.
Yeah, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Booth, and I'm representing Tecumseh, Alaska, the operator of the Red Dog Mine north of Kotzebue. Tecumseh wishes to thank you and the committee for the opportunity to address you today. I'm here to talk about a potential energy source we're looking at to replace our extensive use of diesel fuel. Red Dog produces over a million tons of zinc and lead concentrate each year and ships that product to the DMTS facility south of Kivalina for 3 months of each year. To crush the ore and make the concentrate requires some 28 megawatts of power, using over 18 million gallons of diesel fuel each year. For the past couple of years, we've been looking at and looking for low-pressure methane gas and black shales that occur near the mine. The area surrounding the mine and where we have indications of gas is rolling hills to rugged mountains, much different than either Matanuska Valley or Prudhoe Bay. The rugged nature of the region and the need to have a more flexible definition of the depth limitations for a shallow gas lease is required. Language suggested in AS 3805-177-A1 will assist the state and the leaseholder in knowing what area will be part of the lease. Currently, Tecumseh holds four state shallow gas leases for a total of 23,000 acres. NANA, the owner of the Red Dog Mine, controls the adjoining land to the east, which is nearly 100,000 acres. So the total that we have is in the order of 123,000 acres. To adequately cover a resource target or concept takes considerable acreage. We support the increase in the acreage. Surface ownership in this portion of Alaska is fairly straightforward, with three major landowners. The National Park Service, whose land we know is off limits, the state of Alaska, and private lands of NANA. So the issue of addressing the surface owner separately is not an issue for us. Developments of shallow gas in northwest Alaska has many impediments that other areas of Alaska share, some that they don't. Location is the major impediment due to access and the ability to bring large equipment in and out only in the summer months. The lack of roads in the area and the desire and need to maintain the pristine nature of the region, high cost and very time impediment. Considering this, it will be very difficult, if not impossible, to test a shallow gas lease in that part of Alaska within the 3 years provided in the current lease when work is so seasonal. Logic would say that a lease should be at least 5 years for a primary term with renewal options as provided in the current lease, and someone may want to consider an amendment to cover that. Although not provided in this legislation, we support the 5-year term with renewal options. Arctic Alaska will always present numerous challenges not present elsewhere. Tecumseh, Alaska addresses many of these challenges each and every day at Red Dog. By passing this legislation, you will have addressed a major challenge and impediment that we cannot address. Tecumseh, Alaska supports SB 319. And Madam Chair, I might be available for questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? We have no questions, and at this time, I'd like to ask Mark Myers to come forward or give us your testimony, your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Mark Myers, Director of Division of Oil and Gas, and I just want to thank Senator Torgerson for introducing this legislation. We think it's a big step forward toward the commercialization of shallow gas, particularly coal bed and fractured shale. We've tried to work with the senator and with the parties to try to craft something that works as a package, and I think the elements you've heard do that rather nicely together. And if we could comment on a few of the concerns. The one is the increase in acreage. The 100,000 acres was nothing magical. It was just a recognition that coal bed to be produced has to be produced at a pretty large scale for commercial operations where they depressurize a large area over time. So with that recognition, it's different than a conventional oil and gas play and may, in fact, require more acreage to do on a commercial scale. So we have no objections to the six townships or approximately 138,000 acres versus the 100,000 acres. What we've seen in the program being over-the-counter filing is that it's pretty easy to file and meet the basic qualifications anyway, and we've seen family members stack on each other to create aggregates that are, in fact, at that same scale. So, again, I think we really have no real protections to prevent an individual or consortium to acquire a large group of acreage. In fact, I've seen that in the conventional program. So again, the 46,000 acres hasn't been an impediment for affiliated organizations or affiliated people to bid in aggregate together. So, in fact, I'd personally rather see the primary party who's interested in exploring be able to acquire the significant amount of acreage needed to unitize. And the 138,000 give you enough for two substantial units for solid unitized production. One of the other concerns, again, was the worry about lockup. I think the three-year term has the converse effect that to Mr. Booth had testified, that it does require the leases turn over. The commissioner can, with his discretion, renew that for three additional years. So, in fact, if you're making progress toward exploration development, you, in fact, probably have a six-year lease, at which point you would assume that you would go into some kind of unitized production to maintain the acreage over an area. So, again, we think it works. We think the three-year term's an aspect of this not holding the acreage forever. We think, again, the higher fees are necessary, they for one thing, for the program to pay for itself, but also to try to discourage just rampant speculation. So someone has to be serious about acquiring it. A dollar an acre, again, we think probably a flat fee over a graduated fee is better, because we don't want to penalize someone that wants to produce a large aggregate of acreage efficiently together in a unitized form. On the comments about the 90 days, we found that impractical. We simply can't do it for a number of reasons. One is, again, we had to go through the title work. We found because of the lack of title insurance, we couldn't guarantee the title work had been adequately, so we ended up doing it ourselves. We figured, why burden the applicant if we are, in fact, doing it ourselves? Also, I think it helps justify the higher fee. The other thing is that we have to go through stipulations and mitigation measures for environmental protection, and those are unique area by area. I don't know if any of you have been involved with that process, but we're not the only agency involved with that. So the interagency effect, there's elevations commonly with other agencies like Fish and Game that may disagree with the environmental protections. We also generally, in many of the areas, have to go through the ACMP process. So, again, to do all that in 90 days is totally unrealistic, no matter our best intent. And finally, we have to balance, with the staff we have to balance the use of our folks for title work for conventional lease sales, our exploration licenses, and our shallow gas leasings. And we balance that on a need-to-need basis as best we can, but obviously we see the programs bringing in the most revenue to the state as the most important, and we tend to prioritize our work toward that. So not having the deadlines gives us flexibility. We work hard to get these leases out, and every chance we get, we do work on them, including, in fact, hiring contractors to do some of the title work. So we're motivated. We want to see the program work. We think it's an important resource, particularly in the Mat Valley, the Big Delta, and the Lower Kenai, where we think it can work commercially, as well as be very appropriate use there in the Red Dog Mine area. So hopefully that's answered some of the questions and some of the concerns with the timing issue. We believe the higher fees, again, are justifiable and supportable by the industry, and the program will have net positive benefits, and we think it works as whole to stimulate commercial development of coal bed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mark. Are there any questions? Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mark, for addressing the time limit issue. I have absolute faith in you and your department and your support of this program. My concern, I guess, would just be that folks like you might not be around 5 or 6 or 7 years from now. I don't know, but is there a time limit that you believe is appropriate? I understand from both your testimony and that of the sponsor, Senator Torgerson's, that 90 days certainly does not work, but is there a time limit that you think that would be reasonable and not too onerous and yet place some kind of an incentive to process the applications other than simply saying after the completion of a title search?
Representative McGuire, through the chair, I think, you know, one of the ways the legislature tests us is through our missions and measures.